When you choose to work with a deadline for your entire working life, you gotta be a little bit crazy. And crazy is great radio. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Got our coffee order in. We're good to go here.
Ready to go. Big show.
Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch. That is the most important thing, of course, to get the coffee order.
This show requires caffeine.
Yeah, it really does.
Unquestionably.
Every show requires caffeine.
That's true.
We have a busy show today. Elliot Friedman, one of our regular NHL insiders, joins us. Manny Osborne parodies will join us in studio. Tomorrow is, I believe it's tomorrow, is the 100th anniversary of Alpine Canada. And Manny Osborne parodies attempting the mother of all comebacks. So we'll talk to him about where his comeback currently is. And looking ahead to 2020, Jeff Passan, our regular baseball insider, will join us. Mr. Passan has written an encyclopedic look ahead at the offseason. And as per usual, I agree with, I think, 20 points. I think I agreed with 19 of them. So Passan will be along at 3 o'clock, 2:25. This is going to be a lot of fun. Hubie Brown, NBA analyst with ESPN. The Kings and Raptors will play tomorrow night on Sportsnet 590. The Fan and Sportsnet 1 pregame is at 7. Tip-off is just after 7:30 on 590 and Sportsnet 1. Eric and Paul with the call on the radio. Matt, Leo, Brad Fay, Michael Grange, Daniel Michaud on the TV side. Hubie Brown, of course, famous in these parts. Well, first of all, he's famous because he is, without question, well, he's my, I take notes of games Hubie calls. Hubie's also the guy who voted for Fred Van Vliet for finals MVP last year, which was an inspired pick.
I agree.
And one that I heartily endorsed and heartily agreed with. So I'm looking forward to having Hubie on.
Hubie's
80. You were telling us off air. How old is he? He's 83?
I think he's 85. Somebody can fact check me on that. So a couple things about Hubie Brown that they're just worth mentioning before we have him on later. One, think about the totality, Jeff, of this guy's career. He was an assistant coach with the Bucks for Lou Alcindor, you know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Oscar Robertson. So an assistant coach literally on the bench coaching those guys.
Right.
That in itself is amazing. Fast forward however many years later, a little under 40, he's coaching the Memphis Grizzlies against LeBron James.
Mm-hmm.
So his career as a coach spans from Kareem and Oscar to LeBron. That's incredible.
That's essentially everybody. Other than George Mikan.
Essentially, yeah, other than George Mikan. Other than...
Who are you covering other than that? Yeah.
Yeah, other than whoever, like, is the preeminent players of the 50s.
Dolph Shays, man.
And that's not even, I feel like that's not even basketball.
Right.
It's sort of like some hybrid.
Right.
Then before that, he was a college coach for a little bit. He was an athlete at Niagara, so he's very familiar with this area. He's been in Toronto a million times. Was an ABA coach and a champion in a different league, which was this incredible
ABA
league.
Yeah.
And then this is why this guy, I mean, again, he is one of the greatest basketball figures, in my opinion, of all time. Everything I just said was dealing with either coaching or basketball. In addition to that, Jeff, the guy has been one of the preeminent broadcasters in the NBA in the last 30 years. I don't think anyone will ever duplicate his career. There's almost no way you would be coaching, you know what I mean, coaching that long and then having a broadcasting career like this. Nor do I think... After the Scully, Hubie, Vern Lundquist, Al Michaels group, I don't think they're going to let guys broadcast till they're 80 anymore.
How did he? I'm going to ask you to jog my memory here a bit. But how does his career arc differ from Dr. Jack Ramsey's? Another TV analyst, another well-known TV analyst who certainly, for me anyhow, was a guy that I saw an awful lot.
Yeah,
when I started watching basketball,
and another amazing guy. I think Ramsey's a touch older than him. Ramsey coached for a long time in college basketball. I think famously St. Joe's.
Okay.
Then eventually coach Portland, right? We coached the Walton
Blazers
NBA championship team. Ramsey got out at a certain point and I think just stayed in basketball.
Okay.
The difference in the arc with Hubie is Hubie coached in the 80s, famously coached the Knicks and some other teams, took a break, became a basketball analyst, and then went back to the NBA, where I don't think, and again, maybe a listener can correct me, I don't think once Ramsey left the NBA, I don't think he ever went back. I think he was just a broadcaster. But again, like, Hubie Brown's career is not going to be duplicated. I'm not so sure how many guys who coach that long one are going to want to go into broadcasting. And then it's almost inconceivable that we'll see a broadcaster get this kind of paramount games in his 80s. I don't know if...
Guy was working the finals. Think about the guy was working the finals.
For ESPN Radio. There's not going to be another guy like this. He's sort of a unique walking version of basketball. And again, if you just think about him with the Bucks and then fast forward it to his, I think, 2 years or year and a half with the Grizzlies, he literally saw everybody, which is amazing. Remarkable. And as a broadcaster now, like, if you want to sort of extend it, like, he's seeing Zion and he's seeing the youngest of the guys. So his career in basketball, I mean, I'm trying to think. I know Don Cherry had a long career as a coach and then as a broadcaster, and maybe there's a little bit of parallels, but I don't know if there's a parallel.
Don Cherry coached a lot in the American Hockey League.
Yeah, it's different, right? I mean, Hubie Brown was always a top flight coach.
Yes.
You know, even the ABA, his team, the Kentucky Colonials, I think it was.
Colonels. Kentucky Colonels.
They won the championship.
Like, so Bobby Jones and that? No, Bobby Jones.
Artis Gilmore,
right. Yeah.
But they were champions. Dan Issel.
I need to.
Louis Dampier, right?
Refresh Terry Pluto's great book, Foul Balls.
Yeah. I love Hubie. I know there are some out there who are like, you know, time to retire Hubie, talks too much. I would be fine if Hubie Brown called every NBA basketball game.
Yeah,
I love the guy.
I'd be fine with that as well. So that'll be a lot of fun. Hubie Brown at 2:25, and we'll talk to Hubie a little bit about Pascal Siakam, who Nick Nurse had some comments about today.
Yeah.
Ahead of tomorrow night's game against Sacramento. We touched a little bit on it yesterday with Paul Jones about the offensive fouls and just the fouls in general and the turnovers that that we're seeing from the Raptors, which is part of the game that their game that really needs cleaning up. We mentioned that, I think we mentioned, if we didn't, we should have, that the LA Kings are in town tonight to take on the Leafs at Scotiabank Arena. We'll have our Leafs Nation post game with Stelic and Alberga immediately following the final horn. John Tavares is back in the lineup. Nick Pitan has been called up. Jason Spezza and Dmitry Timoshov are out of the lineup for the Toronto Maple Leafs tonight. Cody Ceci still in. It's going to be... Mike Babcock called John Tavares the conscience of the team a couple of days ago when he was discussing his absence. And there's been kind of an interesting story here in that Mike Babcock has made it pretty clear that... I wouldn't say that he thinks the medical staff erred on the side of was overcautious with John Tavares, but he sort of indicated that if it was entirely up to him, John Tavares would have been playing by now. He was supposed to play against the Philadelphia Flyers, didn't play, but it's good to get him back. Even though the Kings aren't the strongest team in the league, it's good to get John Tavares back. And see if perhaps now that John Tavares is here, now that Zach Hyman, we're led to believe, could be back on the weekend. Travis Dermott is healthy and playing. Jake Muzzin is back after missing the game in Philadelphia for personal reasons. Richard, we're now almost getting to the point where we are going to see what we thought this Leafs team would look like.
Yeah, I feel
this
like-
year. And now I think it was Elliot Friedman, and he'll join us later, who mentioned that if you're the Leafs right now, the plan is, okay, let's get everybody healthy. Let's see how all the pieces fit together. Because I think sometimes we are guilty of overlooking the fact that when a team is put together, it is viewed as a whole. and there are parts that fit because other parts are in the lineup. You take those parts out of the lineup, some other parts don't fit. And we are at the stage now, we're very close to the stage, Richard, where we're going to see the team that Kyle Dubas thought he was going
to
have.
Yeah. I think like 3 weeks from now, 1 month from now, assuming everybody or hopefully everybody stays healthy, you're going to be able to make a pretty accurate and honest assessment of what the Maple Leafs are. But you, to me, hit the point that is important and really needs to be repeated is when players of John Tavares's caliber are out, Jeff, it changes everything, both lineup-wise, but not that. I think even in terms of sort of pressure psychologically, it puts more pressure on other guys to perform and perhaps do things that are a little bit out of their skill set. And so now Travis Dermott is back. I think Nick Batan's going to be good. It seems like he's been basically blowing up the AHL. Muzzin is back, and then obviously Hyman will be back. And finally, we get the team that I think both of us, when we were talking about our preseason predictions, were like, this looks like an Eastern Conference final team or finalist team. The one thing I didn't expect, but I have to sort of tip my hat to, is the Bruins look unbelievable. Like, that looks like a Stanley Cup winner. It's still early. Things happen, but they seem to have all the pieces. But I'm really looking forward to the Maple Leafs team in full to sort of finally get a sense of what this group could potentially be. And it'll be really interesting, Jeff, in particular on the special teams, if John Tavares's reappearance, like if that solves the power play problem. Is it having him back in, does that ultimately provide for them what they want in terms of getting those numbers up? Does it free up other special teams? I'll be really curious to see. And then finally, my last point is, I've been thinking about this the last couple of days. You know, we probably don't give Freddie Anderson enough credit for as good as he is. And I know you never would sort of, I know the thought or the de facto thought is always the best player on the team is probably your first line center, or maybe it's your star wing. But like, he has just reminded us, like, over the first parts of the season, like, without that guy, like, this is not a playoff team at all.
Well, he's the most valuable player
by
on the
a
team.
Lot. I think that
was the case last year, and that hasn't changed.
Even in ties this year, I think he's proven that. I mean, I feel like he has bailed them. I know the save percentage is a little down, but he has bailed them out in so many situations. So it also, I guess, reemphasizes the point, man. Imagine you had a quality backup mm-hmm. and what that would mean. But I'm looking forward to seeing the Leafs in full over the next couple of weeks.
That process will begin tonight, as we mentioned. John Tavares in the lineup. Hopefully, we get to see Zach Hyman back soon. I think Mike Babcock said today that he started to hear Hyman today, so that means that he's getting close
Good.
To getting back. And that is, this is never going to be a tough, gritty team. It's not designed that way. It's designed to win with skill. But Zach Hyman is probably the only guy in that forward line that has a little bit of that aspect to his game.
Yeah.
I think probably just by virtue of the fact of where he's expected to go when he's with that line. He's expected to go into the corners and get the puck and be strong along the boards. And I think his return will give them a little bit of that. And I hesitate to use the word presence, but we'll give them a little bit of that sandpaper, I guess, that they've lacked. And I will say this as well. It's far too early to judge that trade with Colorado. And I believe that Tyson Barrie is going to be, as we've said, a terrific addition to this team. But there have been times, Richard, where I've watched this team and I've thought, man, I would love to see Nazem Kadri out in the ice. There have been times where that has been called for. Just the idea of being out there and forcing your opponent to keep his head up.
Yeah, so. I mean, you know, the thing with Kadri, of course, Jeff, is it he plays on that proverbial line. So if you can dance on that line, it's really invaluable for a team. Problem is, of course, in the last couple of playoff series, he's gone over the line. and it really can cost you. But, yeah, you know, I don't want to sort of be a Monday morning quarterback. I love the trade.
Oh, I did too at the time, and I'm not.
And I think they're going to be good. But what's clear is, at least in Tyson Barrie's case, is the adjustment has taken longer, I would imagine, than he and Leafs management expected. But, you know, I am reminded, it's the same thing with Muzzin. And maybe hockey is a sport where it's, you know, it's not as easy to come into a team and a philosophy and just, and you know, stylistically and excel right away. It seems like in basketball and some other sports, the person who moves to a new team, Jeff, you know what I mean, can immediately, maybe it's just sort of the nature of the sport, but in other sports, it seems like, particularly in basketball, you can move to another team and be great right away, as, for example, Kyrie Irving and Kawhi Leonard are. But for Tyson Barrie, you know, he still looks a little bit of a tick off, getting better, but it's still not there yet.
As Jeff Merrick said yesterday, you know, I think now that this group is back together, to me, the spotlight really shifts at Cody Ceci right now, because It's not that he's necessarily gotten a pass from everybody. I mean, there are flaws to his game, and people have talked about that a lot. But it always seems as if there was some other issue, whether Tavares was hurt or Hyman's coming back or Dermott's coming back, and then they hit on Muzzin and Muzzin missed a game. But once this group is together, I will be fascinated to see what happens with Cody Ceci, because I'm with Merrick. Cody Ceci, to me, is very, very close to getting a spot in the press box. If it was me, he'd probably already have the spot in the press box. But this is, there's a political aspect to this, right? This is a trade that your general manager made.
Exactly.
And the thing we know about professional sports is there's a dynamic between general manager and coach, and it's not always one of headbutting, but there is kind of there's an unspoken delineation between I'll give you this, but you got to give me this. You know, you always used to hear in baseball, the 25th guy in the team is a guy that the manager really liked or the GM really liked.
Yeah.
And I think we may be in that position. Mike Babcock's got some political battles he's got to fight. Conversely, Kyle Dubas does as well. And I don't think it's necessarily settled over Cody Ceci yet. But, you know, we're getting the point. I think we all have faith in Tyson Barrie. We all see what he did. Tyson Barrie didn't come over here with the same baggage Cody Ceci did.
Yeah.
Cody Ceci's come over with the baggage of being kind of a square peg in a round hole type of a dude. And so once everybody gets back, it'll be fun to see how the ice time is distributed and what happens with the defense pairings once Travis Dermott is fully healthy and engaged and Jake Muzzin is engaged. I mean, if it's up to me, I would like to see Tyson Barrie and Morgan Rielly together on the ice just to see, because I think they owe it to Morgan Rielly after giving him, you know, a steady diet of Cody Ceci as a defense partner.
I was just going to say, to me, that I think that's where I think that
that's how you get both guys going.
Yeah, I think the decision has been made. If you're sort of looking at statistically in the eye test, you have to protect Morgan Rielly, I feel like, and I think that's the reason why I would move Ceci. Morgan Riley's numbers and ice time are off, and I think I'm with you. Whether it's Tyson Barrie or someone else, I think he needs a different partner in order to get him going, because, Jeff, you ultimately can't get to where you want to be without Morgan Rielly, you know, as a top 10 defenseman.
Absolutely.
And he just hasn't been that player this year.
Hubie Brown is ESPN's lead NBA analyst. We're very excited, as we said it in our opening, to be joined by Hubie Brown. And we'll have him on the other side. Hubie Brown's next. It's Writer's Block with Blair and Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
A writer's block with Blair and Deitch. We'll run down Travis McKenzie's guilty pleasure list later on. Off to a smoking hot start. You okay, Deitch?
Yeah, for some reason, I'll be trying to get my headset in here in a second. Keep talking, Blair.
I shall. The Toronto Raptors take on the Sacramento Kings. I was there yesterday. Now you know what I feel like. Take on the Sacramento Kings tomorrow night at Scotiabank Arena, 7:30 tip-off. Nick Nurse had some interesting comments today about Pascal Siakam. I don't know if I'd say it wasn't really pointed criticism. I think it was more sort of a statement of the obvious, some of the things we've seen or we have not seen from Pascal Siakam so far this year, at a time where I think we all agree he has kind of become the guy on this team. We talked to Paul Jones yesterday a little bit about the turnovers, and Paul pointed out that he thought part of the issue was some of the offensive fouls leading to turnovers that Pascal Siakam was committing. So this is Nick Nurse, the head coach of the Raptors, earlier today addressing the issue of Pascal Siakam and his fouls.
He hasn't been very smart, if you want me to be honest with you. Most of those have been fouls, and they're touch fouls that they're not calling on everybody, and they're not calling every trip up and down. But if you go back and by the letter of the law, you say, hey, he's got two hands on him, so he's got to take the two hands off him. And that's what we're working on. Just we're pouring over the film. We're showing him, you know, just a little bit, and that's okay. I mean, it's something he can change quickly. So I'm not sure why he's doing it now, and I don't know if it has anything to do with anything other than he needs to knock it off, right? Just needs to knock it off. And again, I don't remember him being a foul prone guy at all, right? All for some reason, all of a sudden he's picking up too early in games. And again, like most of them are silly, and he's not. It's not like he's being put in difficult situations. A lot of them are 30 feet from the basket or 20 feet from the basket, and he's just got his hands on him. He's got to adjust.
That was Nick Nurse addressing the media today, talking about Pascal Siakam and his foul issues. It's one of the things we wanted to talk to Hubie Brown about. He is our next guest. He is ESPN's NBA analyst. Hubie, thanks so much for joining Richard Deitch and myself. It's
a real pleasure. No problem.
It's an honor for us. So Nick Nurse said he has to knock it off, essentially, that Pascal Siakam has to knock it off. Hubie, when you become the guy on the team, or one of the guys in the team, as Pascal has become, how much more emphasis or how much more focus is there on you from officials, from opposing teams?
Well, it depends upon the officials that come out. Every night you have a different personality. And if you just played back-to-back nights, the same team, and then you just came with three different officials each night, the game would be refereed differently. Mm. When you coach in the league, you understand that. You explain it to your team after 5-7 minutes into the first half and second half of how the game is being called. And that has to be brought out, especially to your high scorer, who right now has stepped up and is playing great basketball. Nick's trying to send him a message that we need you for your full minute rotations. And you cannot have you sitting on the bench for long periods of time because of dumb fouls. And you say, well, they should honor the fact that he's averaging 26 points and he's shooting a high percentage and he's doing all these great things. That's true. But the key is, he's still a young player and he has to understand he's now at a different plateau. We've moved you up in the chain now. We need you on the floor. If it's going to be 38 minutes, 38 minutes. You cannot get yourself into bad situations, because we all know this year there are an awful lot of new young referees in the league, and they are not privy to your talent yet and to where you are expected to perform nightly in Toronto. So that has to come with time. It's early in the season, but Nick's trying to straighten the guy out, and I like what he's doing because they need him.
Hubie, first, great to hear your voice, as always. I want to ask you about the Raptors this year, and I imagine you have been in this situation before in one of your coaching stops, but how difficult or how challenging is it to go from one year where you have a definitive late-game scorer, as the Raptors did in Kawhi Leonard, and then to try to figure out who that person is just a couple of months later?
Well, first of all, you got to understand that every time that you're on the floor, there has to be three scorers. And right now, Lowry, Van Fleet, and Siakam are answering that. Gasol is late right now, contributing major numbers, but that's okay because we all know that he's played a lot of basketball from even the end of last season. So you look at that and you say now, are you going to rotate 8 guys in the big games like you did in the playoffs when you held Golden State and then also Milwaukee, 2 teams that average 117 and 116 during the year and during the playoffs? You held them to more than 10 to 12 less points in all the big wins. So consequently, defense is a major thing. But then when you're rotating and you're only going to rotate 8 guys, then 3 scorers have got to be on the floor at a time. We used to rotate 10 guys. We rotated 10 all the time until we got to the playoffs. The main thing was we have 3 guys out there that we're going to. They're going to be the primary shot attempt people. And then also on the second unit. See, right now we have a lot of good teams out west that have great starting units, but their backup teams, their second unit guys can't score. So when it gets to playoff time, when we get down to the nitty gritty, first, second round, third round, well, now all of a sudden, where is the scoring going to come from? So to me, it's a challenge to the coaching staff because you always have to get your 3 best scorers high percentage shots in their best areas. I don't care what offense you run. I don't care what you're doing in transition, but you have to get them high percentage shots in their best areas. And they have to understand the difference between a bad shot and a good shot, a good percentage shot for the team, because you're not trying now to make the playoffs. You're trying to get into that third round conference finals and finals. So it's a different type of terminology that you would use with Toronto versus, say, a Chicago or a New York or one of these teams that are just trying to get the 500.
Hubie, since you're on in the city and we have you, and Jeff and I both think this was an inspired selection, I do want to ask you. Last year, you were the only person to vote for Fred VanVleet for NBA Finals MVP, won by Kawhi Leonard. And I think, I'm not sure anyone in this market has asked you that, but what was your thought process behind selecting Fred for the Finals MVP?
Well, look, coaches look at things a little differently sometimes. I just thought that in that game that you had to win, and the game before that, he stepped up big, not only shooting great percentages with the 3 ball, but he made the threes inside of 3 to 4 seconds, which was maximizing the pressure on the shot. So consequently, he did an incredible job for you offensively, but more important, he took Curry out of the last quarter in the key wins. And that alone should have gotten incredible ink across from television and from guys that were witnessing the games and writing about the games. He was able to hold Curry down in shot attempts and then in field goal percentage, and then also turned him over a number of critical times. So when you look at it from that game, the key game that night, to me, if Golden State would have won that game, I had on the paper Iguodala that night for that game. And then in this game, I had VanVleet because of the tremendous pressure that he played under and that he gave it to you. But a lot of times, key defense is overlooked in the pressurized ending of the great games. Could you stop their best guy who had to do it for them at that time because no Durant and then no Thompson? This young man stepped up and did it and laid it out there physically for you. So I thought that, you know, he should be mentioned.
Hubie, what do you make of the Raptors this year?
Well, I think they're in the chase. Why not? I think that what you have to do is develop that small forward position because you still have your 3-man rotation at center and power forward. And if Nick's going to stay in the big games and eight-man rotation, well, then you're still solid right there. And they're going to be able to score against anybody, rebound, et cetera, with Siakam, Gasol, and Ibaka. Now, the big key is by playing Van Vliet and then Lowry together, naturally, their scoring is up over last year. More shot attempts now, and they're going to shoot a good percentage for you, and they're going to shoot big the three ball for you. Now it comes down to the third guy there. Is it going to be Powell again, like at that position, or at small forward coming off the bench? Well, when you look at the small forward position, what do you want out of that position now? Point-wise, you can look as a coaching staff and say, shot attempts, et cetera, will build up the scoring for those other five guys. Okay, now, what do we want out of the players that are the two guys that are at that small forward position and then the swing guy who comes off the bench that can play either position? Well, when you look at that, you have to honestly look at it and say, are they capable of getting X amount of points each night? Well, in order to do that, you've got to get them that amount of catches in their best areas, all right, so that they feel that not only are they a part of the team defensively and rebounding, but also that they have a position with the team night in and night out that they're going to get shots. And can they do that not only against the sub-500s, because you're asking them now to give you more points against the plus-500s. Mm. And I think that's how you have to look at it. But from experience, from style of play, from the coaching staff, you're going to be in the hunt. And I know everybody's blowing a load of smoke on Milwaukee and Philadelphia in the East, which they should. But then again, they're both a little weak. Philly's bench is very questionable. And Milwaukee, that guard position, when you give up a player like Brogdon, that leaves you not only the points, but then also the shooting percentages, field goal threes and foul line, and then the great defense, plus the fact he can make the play either at the point guard or two guard for you under pressure. So that was a major loss. So to me, you're in the hunt. Why not? You should be, and you should be feeling good about your team.
Hubie, there literally is no other person on earth I would want to ask this question of, given your experience and years in the game. When you watched Nick Nurse last year, particularly in the championship, and I know that when you watch a game, you also are evaluating coaches and how they do out-of-bounds plays and certain things like that. What did you learn or what did you discover about Nick Nurse?
Courage. He had courage to make critical moves, reducing your rotations, playing matchup zones, all right, at different times. He did the unexpected, which he has done over in England and then at the small college jobs and then down there in the D League or G League, whatever we want to call it. He's not afraid to make the bold move and then suffer the consequence because of his personality if it doesn't work out. That, to me, jumped right off the page every single game, whether it was against Milwaukee or whether it was against Golden State. And remember now, you were big underdogs in both of those.
Right.
And you came out because he got the team to believe in what he was presenting, even though it wasn't the normal or what people wanted. He had the courage to step up and do his job, philosophy-wise, what he believed in, and laid it out there. And I thought that was tremendous, night in and night out.
Hubie, as
that's
a coach,
hard to do.
I was going to say, as a coach, how difficult is it to institute something new in a game, interest your players to the point where they're going to carry it out, but also not kind of do away with their whole comfort zone? Like, how do you find that balance between being innovative and being bold and at the same time making sure your guys are in position to do what they do best?
Yeah, well, the big thing there is it has to come with practice.
Okay.
Come on, you can't do things without it being in practice. The best coaches on timeouts, underneath the basket, on the side, are running great plays that they run every day against your zone or your man. And the good coaching staffs have plays under and side out of bounds against zone or man. Now, the teams that are sub 500, you'd have to question whether or not they play the same as you do inside of the last 5 minutes. Because you have got to understand that what goes in the first 43 minutes might not go in the last 5 minutes. Plus, who are you going to in the last 5 minutes? Are you going to the key guys that night, or are you going to the guys that you know have been able to do it for you in previous games? They all have pet plays that they shoot the best out of, percentage shots, et cetera, and so forth, but also where they're comfortable getting the ball. So that comes with through practice and repetitions, and then also in previous games that you might not think that they did something, but they were working on it in games where they might be ahead by 20, 25 points and are working on different things. You can always tell the IQ of the coaching staff when you see all of that as you're watching a game.
Hubie, last one from us, about a 90 seconds or so. I'm going to sort of fanboy here a little bit. You, I believe, were coaching the Grizzlies when LeBron James was a rookie. Do I have my chronology right? Does that sound right?
Yes.
Okay, so yes. My question is, what was it like game planning for LeBron James when he was a rookie in the league?
Hello, LeBron James, to me, came in a man. He was a man. And he came into the league, and there have been a number of other guys like him, Garnett, et cetera. We can go to Moses Malone that came in right out of high school, like a Kobe Bryant. They came in with, I hate that word, stagger, but they had it. They had incredible confidence in what they can do. But I used to say this about LeBron James. I was a big fan of his right off the bat when I saw the size at 6'8", the 260, and then I would tell people, you don't like LeBron James? That's fine, because at that time, a lot of people did not like him in his first 5, 6, 7 years in the league, because people were saying, well, is he as good as Michael Jordan? Well, people didn't want to hear that, okay? Well, I don't care which side of the fence you were on, but here's what I would say to people. He can score with his back to the basket. He can score in the open floor with either hand. He has a mid-range game, and like all guys that were learning the three distance coming out of high school or coming out of college, all right, he could make the big three when it counted under pressure. And then I'd say this. Give me three players in the league that are faster than LeBron James from basket to basket with or without the basketball. And you would stump them. Guys in the league, coaches, management people, guys that covered a team, because his athleticism was off the charts. Not just because of the speed, but the strength, where you would bounce off of him when you tried to foul him hard going to the rim. You would bounce away from him. And that's when I did Zion Williamson in an exhibition game against Chicago. That's what I saw that he had at his size, 6'6", and 285, okay? He had that ability to, from the foul line down, for you to bounce off of him. So you do not disrupt his shot no matter how hard you try to foul him. So the vision. Now, Zion does not have the vision that LeBron came into the league with. Because when LeBron came into the league, he was good as the majority of the point guards that were in the league in seeing all 10 guys, the other 9 people. and seeing ahead of. When you talk about the legendary guys, like the top 10 or 12 guys that ever played, you have to see that they see the game in slow motion. You don't see the game in slow motion. Most players don't see the game in slow motion. They see the game in slow motion and can visualize what they should do with the ball. That's why they make incredible plays when they're being trapped, or whether it's a three-man gang up on them. They'll make the correct play because they have not only the vision, but they also have the ability to put the ball where the ball has to go. I'm going to wear you out talking about LeBron James.
that's fine. Believe me, we do not mind being worn out by you, and we certainly don't mind being worn out about LeBron James. Hubie, listen, thanks so much for joining us. Again, it's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Anytime.
And be well.
Thank you, Hubie.
Anytime. Okay. Richard, good talking to you earlier.
Always, Hubie. Right. Great to catch up
with you. Things go well for you guys. You know, you can call anytime. You know that.
Thank you, Hubie.
Take care.
Take care.
That's the great Hubie Brown, and large thanks to Mr. Deitch here for setting that up today.
He's so great. But that, even like his
hard not to fanboy with him.
Oh yeah, and just one. Think of how specific he was with the Raptors.
Yeah,
and like what he gave you, and two, and I wasn't sure where he was going to answer this. His answer about Nick Nurse was unbelievable.
Yeah,
like again, specifics. Like what is it you see? Courage. The guy has the cojones to do this at this situation. He's whatever he is, 85, 84. The guy, don't tell me that guy's not sharper than any 30-year-old analyst you've ever heard. Unbelievable.
We are going to take a break. We'll come back, put a bow on it, and then be joined by Jeff Passan. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, welcome back to Writer's Block. Jeff Passan joins us at 3 o'clock as we play Travis McKenzie's Guilty Pleasure List.
Oh, yeah. What was that song that we just heard on the radio?
This is Eddie Murphy, isn't it?
Party All the Time?
God.
It's actually a pretty good choice by Travis. I like that.
Well, at least we're talking about somebody who is
that's a guilty pleasure.
A talented member of Saturday Night Live's cast as opposed to the vast majority of.
You don't think the cast now is good?
Nah, cast now.
Kate McKinnon is great.
And who else?
Yeah, right. I didn't think about that one. I think the Weekend Update, I think Michael Che is funny. There's been better casts than this one, but I still think, and I don't know, to me, going up live and doing comedy is hard. That's a hard job. So I think Cicely Strong is pretty good. How about that? Mm. But yeah, I mean, What's the greatest set? What's the heyday Saturday Night Live, you think?
I mean, I like the Garrett Morris era.
Oh, like so
the,
like Chevy way, Chase way back?
Chevy Chase.
What do you think of like the Martin Short, Crystal, that era? Dana Carvey?
Nah.
Sandler, really. Farley, that group? No.
Belushi, those guys. That was when Saturday Night Live.
It is hard to top the original.
That's when
group.
It was cutting edge. Now it's like, you know, who's on, which music guest is on.
Yeah, I'm trying to sort of think of like.
Anyhow.
It's hard. Yeah, it's hard to top that original cast.
We'll send out Travis McKenzie's Guilty Pleasure List.
Can I just say I love Phil Hartman, though? I love that guy.
Yeah, you can say that. You just did.
Anyway.
Phil Hartman dead?
He's dead. Yeah, died in a horrible situation. Yeah, a domestic incident.
Yeah.
He was an incredible talent.
Speaking of incredible talent, Jeff Passan joins us.
What a segue.
Perfect segue. Deitch, you teed it up for me. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. It's Writer's Block on 360 and 590.
Expanding on all of the top sports headlines, this is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Joined in studio in a few minutes by Manny Osborne Parody. It is the 100th anniversary of Alpine Canada tomorrow. Manny Osborne Parody. Little of a comeback, I guess. from a an injury.
A terrible
injury doesn't. Yeah, injury doesn't do it. Doesn't do it justice. It was a tibia injury suffered at Lake Louise a year ago. Doctors ranked the injury. I'm reading from a press release, the information supplied by our very good friend Chris Dornan. Doctors ranked the tibial fracture as a 5 out of 6 on the Schatzker scale. I did not know there's a Schatzker scale.
Same.
But my guess is when you're 5 out of 6 on it, it ain't good. So anyhow, we'll talk to Manny about that. It was a pretty all-inclusive surgery would probably be the best way to put it. So we'll talk to Manny about that as well. And take a look ahead to the ski season coming up. Jeff Passan is our MLB insider. And he's with ESPN. He joins us on Writer's Block. Hello, Mr. Passan.
Hello.
So you're already talking free agency. Well, I guess that's kind of the way it goes.
I mean, it's the way it's supposed to go.
Yeah, I know, right? I know. You make it very obvious in your 20 big hot stove questions that you're one of those people. See, I've always viewed that if I do my job right as a general manager or coach, I probably shouldn't have to make big acquisitions. But it's like we have this thing where, you know, we want teams to make trades because yes, it provides grist for the rumor mill and off-season discussion and all that. But in an ideal world, Jeff, wouldn't I not have to make a trade or sign a free agent? And you know I'm playing devil's advocate here to make a point.
I mean, are you trying to describe my ideal world? Because I would love that. I would love to have November and December and January off.
Uh-huh. And
yeah, I mean, let's make it happen. let's make all of the general managers wonderfully efficient. Every team will be 81-81. There will be a 30-way tie. Oh, I think this sounds great.
That may happen. I could see a 30-way tie. The way things are going in the game, I can absolutely see that. All kidding aside, look, Garrett Cole, we are talking, I like putting this, instead of putting an actual number on it, we're basically talking $250 million here, aren't we, for Garrett Cole?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the floor. Oof. And look, maybe my read on the market is wrong, but last year I did say, and I'd like to think I was pretty consistent in saying that I thought Manny Machado and Bryce Harper both were going to get $300 million, and they did. I think this is a game very much like hockey, where the best players get paid a lot and everyone else kind of doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And you've seen that. I'm not going to call it stars and scrubs because honestly, some of the best players in the game get paid next to nothing because of the way that MLB salary structure works. But you've seen that stars and scrubs ethos creeping more and more into the game. And that's becoming the reality of it right now. And when you have a pitcher the caliber of Garrett Cole, and I've argued, and I think it's a pretty compelling argument, that he might be the best free agent pitcher of all time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you combine the year he is coming off of, the age, the present stuff, the intelligence, the just everything that he has, I mean, man, he is so good and so right for so many of these teams.
Jeff, do you expect the same kind of late signings in terms of like the chronology of where we'd be month-wise in the league this year that we saw last year, particularly with the big free agents?
I'll be honest, I don't know what to expect right now because I have two dogs running around and trying to beat me up. But once they get out of here, I'll be able to. Thank you, Sarah.
What are the dogs' names?
The dogs are out of here now. The dogs are Boots and Max. And Boots is named that because he has feet that would be like size 18 if he were a human being. And Max is named that because these are not my dogs, by the way. These are the neighbor's dogs who are coming over to play. And Max is named Max, I'm guessing, because if you could make the most annoying creature in the world, he is that. And so he is the Max of annoyingness.
Nice.
Yes. As for free agency taking a while, that was the question, Richard,
yes, sir.
Correct?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I think it's going to, because why wouldn't it? And I know that's kind of an unsatisfactory answer, right? Like even a bit of a cop-out answer, but it's the logical one too. For the last two, for sure, and really you could go back to 2016-17 off seasons, you have had teams acting this way, and they haven't had any reason not to because it works. Mm-hmm. Like, it works. And it tends to behoove them almost every time. Like, there aren't many scenarios in which you can say a team did wrong by itself by waiting. Most of them have gotten wins out of this. So why wouldn't they do that when the way that the economic system is set up right now does not necessarily penalize you for not wanting to win and does not incentivize you to want to win? Mm.
Well, I know in this marketplace, I'm sure if you asked the Blue Jays for a redo, they wouldn't have minded waiting a little longer before signing Kenrys Morales and missing out on Edwin. I mean, it's a smaller example than a big free agent, but at the time I remember thinking, you know, sort of congratulating the Jays for being proactive, and then you realize, well, hang on now, if you just waited an extra month, you're going to get a better player, you're going to get better value for the player.
I mean, it's not just that. It's you know, when a player goes into February and doesn't have a job, he starts getting antsy.
Yep.
When a player goes into February and doesn't have a job, his wife starts asking, what are we going to do? Where are we going to live? I mean, there are all sorts of human considerations that go on here, and teams take advantage of that. And they know that almost every time, the guys who wait are the ones who don't wind up getting what they should have. Mm. Or what they would in a, I'm not even going to say a fair market. Maybe they don't wind up getting what they thought they were going to. And that's the thing. How many guys wait and end up where they had hoped? I believe last year it was two, Bryce Harper and Manny Machado. And what's the commonality between them? They were the two best free agents on the market. Best guys can wait. Everybody else, you better consider signing early. And teams right now, including the Blue Jays, by the way, guys, mm-hmm. are out there making phone calls, trying to get players to commit to signing early because they understand there is fear among players that they don't want to be the ones who are left behind.
There's obviously a lot of talk about around Mookie Betts and what type of wild card he might be. And we'll get to that in a minute, but you point out two names that I'm really intrigued in, and that is Chris Bryant and Francisco Lindor, partly because of age, but partly also because of where their teams are. How do you see those situations playing out? And in particular, Chris Bryant, what would the Cubs be looking at, do you think, in return for Chris Bryant?
Well, let me start with Lindor.
Okay.
I don't think Lindor gets traded this offseason. The Indians are always the team that does an incredible amount of due diligence and rarely are the team that actually pulls the trigger. But when you're, 2 years away from free agency and when you understand that a player who has only 1 year left before free agency has markedly less value than a guy who has 2 years or even 1.5 years if you trade him at the deadline this year, you have to at very least consider dealing Francisco Lindor if you don't think you're going to be able to sign him to a contract extension, which the Indians don't, because he is presumably going to want somewhere in the $300 million range. And the way that he has played for the first 5 years of his career, that's pretty warranted considering where the market is. Now Chris Bryant's a different situation. He's got the same number of years of control, but the difference is that the Cubs are in a really sort of odd place right now. And that odd place doesn't have as much to do with their performance on the field, which with Chris Bryant has been really good, not MVP caliber, but really good still. It has more to do with their clubhouse and how they feel that the culture there just was not great. You know, it was not a winning culture, and they feel like they have to change things up. And so the names you hear most often are Wilson Contreras and Chris Bryant. And what the Cubs, here's what the Cubs theoretically could do. Now, this would be a hard, hard needle to thread. But if you want to talk about how the Cubs can stay competitive in 2019, Cole Hamels and his $20 million salary are gone. You got a hole in your rotation. You can trade Wilson Contreras and Chris Bryant, and you can look to get back prospects from one of them and a major league caliber starting pitcher from another one of them. With Bryant, you shed probably $20 or so million in salary because that's what he's going to make in arbitration. And with Contreras, probably about $6 or $7 million, I think. Beyond that, you go out and sign Anthony Rendon. You want to make your team better? Go out and get the best free agent bat out there. And you want to change your clubhouse? You change it with a couple of the guys who were in the middle of it. And this is not to say that Wilson Contreras or Chris Bryant have been problems. I don't believe that they have. But sometimes when you want to change things up, there are casualties. And fair or not, they may be the ones because Javier Baez, I don't think, is getting traded, and Anthony Rizzo simply won't get traded.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Blair and I were discussing Anthony Rendon, and it seems like there's two lines, maybe the lines of thought is not the right way to say it, but if you're Rendon and you're Scott Boras, you're sort of thinking, I would think, two ways. One, he will have his choice of where he wants to go and can go to a franchise, but he'd have to be, if he moves, he becomes the face of a franchise, which seemingly is a little against personality type. So that sort of comes with, you know, different kind of responsibility. Or you go back to Washington, where you are incredibly comfortable. You're welcome back like a conquering hero. And you, because of the constitution of that team, you're not necessarily the only star face there. How, if you were advising him, or even if you want to just analyze this, how would you approach that, those kind of choices?
I think that is a very astute analysis, Mr. Deitch, and I would tend to agree with you. That said, Anthony Rendon could get paid more money somewhere else where he doesn't have to be the alpha dog, where he doesn't have to be, you know, if he goes to the Dodgers, I mean, you've got plenty of guys there who could protect him. And this has been something that, you know, I've talked with a number of interested teams, like, hey, if you pay this guy $200 million plus, which is what it's probably going to take, isn't there something incumbent on him to be, if not a leader, then somebody who is representing the franchise? And that is a question that they struggle with. That's something that they don't know if, not that he can't be that, but that he doesn't want to be that.
Right.
You know, there are questions about how much Anthony Rizzo likes baseball. Anthony Rendon, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And those are questions that get asked all the time by front office members. And when in the playoffs, you know, someone asks him, hey, Howie Kendrick is winning NLCS MVP honors at 36. What are you going to be doing? And he says, I hope I'm going to be sitting on my couch. Now, Anthony Rendon is a pretty, like, dry, sardonic kind of guy. But that also, you know, that dovetails pretty well with what his reputation is. And so teams wonder, is this the person who we want to pay that much money? I think that he's so good at playing baseball that the answer should be yes, but there are always, you know, I'm not the one who's going out and committing $200 million to someone.
Hey, Jeff, is there any chatter about why he didn't go to the White House, Rendon?
I have not gotten an explanation for that, but I mean, I assume for the same reason that Sean Doolittle didn't.
Okay.
Because he finds our president to be abhorrent.
Yeah. Or I just thought maybe that he had something else to do. I don't know.
Look, maybe he did. Maybe he didn't want to get involved in the political element. Maybe maybe Kurt Suzuki stole his MAGA hat. I don't know.
Jesus. Yeah, that was a great career move.
Yeah, it's quite a thing.
I wanted to ask you about Mookie Betts, and you talk about this in your column. How much of a wild card is Mookie Betts? Is he a wild card at all this offseason?
Can I actually answer your question with a question myself?
Sure.
Because I'm noodling about writing this.
Okay.
And I'm curious whether this seems like a fairly salient point. The Red Sox want to get under the luxury tax threshold. No mm-hmm. question about that. I would say it's understandable if it were, but it's not. It's not understandable for them. It's not understandable for the Dodgers. It's not understandable for the Yankees. The penalties are minuscule
right.
for teams that are over the luxury tax threshold, especially for teams that make the kind of revenues that the Red Sox and Yankees and Dodgers and others who have dipped under that mark do. If you're going to get under the luxury tax threshold, though, don't you do it the year after Mookie Betts might leave?
Yep. That makes more sense.
Doesn't it? Like,
you know, it does.
JD Martinez opted back in yesterday.
Right.
So we know he's either going to be there or he's going to be on the block, but that money is committed at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems like if you got most of the team, and I understand there are flaws on this team, like the starting pitching, big question marks. What's Chris Sale going to be? What's David Price going to be? What's Nathan Uvalde going to be? Can Eduardo Rodriguez repeat what he did last year? Rick Porcello's gone. Who's going to replace him in the rotation? There are a lot of starting pitching questions. But, man, if you have Devers after his breakout year and Bogarts and Betts and Martinez and Benintendi, and if you don't non-tender him, Jackie Bradley Jr., like, there's enough there with the Red Sox. You don't have to squint to see them winning again.
No, not at all.
And to blow this up right now when you've got a chance to win before Betts goes, I just don't know that they're going to get enough back for Mookie Betts to make a trade worthwhile. And if they can't do that, then they're trading just to dump money. And if they're trading just to dump money, well, what's the point of this? The Boston Red Sox dumping money? What's going on here?
If that's the case, I've got to think Chaim Bloom would have stayed in Tampa Bay.
Yeah, but it is the case, Jeff. That's the thing. And look, Chaim Bloom is being paid very handsomely and getting to run one of the marquee franchises in baseball. So on account of 1 year of short-sightedness, I don't think he's not going to take the job. But, man, he is put in a really difficult position if, in fact, that is the mandate that's coming down.
I like what you point out in your column, too. I'd sort of forgotten this, and I admit I don't have the details right in front of me, but you talk about them doing something truly wild, like that Adrian Gonzalez trade, which that's... Man, that's a real Rubicon, dealing with Xander Bogarts and Price and Uvalde and the money remaining in their deals. I mean, it would be interesting.
Bogarts has $120 million left over 6 years. It's a really good contract. Price has $93 million over 3 years. It's not a very good contract. And Uvalde has $51 million over 3 years. So essentially, you are eating, you know, $40-plus million a year.
Oof.
Between Uvalde and Price and hoping you get something out of them in exchange for one of the best shortstops on a really team-friendly contract.
Yeah.
Jeff, you got a quick thought before we go about Chase Anderson, recently acquired by the Blue Jays?
Honestly, no.
Okay. It's honest.
It's honest, and that's kind of what I thought yesterday. I think if he's our opening day starter here in Toronto...
Your opening day starter, Chase Anderson.
There you go, Mr. Passan.
Oh, come on. He's not going to be the opening day starter.
No, but he could be. He could be mid-rotation, depending on what happens. Oh, not crazy.
Yeah.
No.
Wouldn't shock me if he wound up in the rotation.
Mr. Passan, we're going to let you run. Look after the dogs. Get back to writing. Give me something to read tomorrow.
Not happening, but thanks for the
Wait a minute. When are you writing next?
I'll give you something later this week.
Okay, that's
come on, man. You know, Chef. You know, Schefter and Woj are putting something out today.
I'll be good. Take care, Jeff. Appreciate it.
See you,
Jeff.
Lord. Take care, boys.
All righty, that's Jeff Passan of ESPN.
It's a little American media humor there. Again, I'm Passan.
Yeah, Passan
reference Woj and Schefter. His contemporaries.
Yeah, Passan's work ethic is not.
Passan's work ethic is great, but those two are. I mean, Schefter is. Like a cyborg.
Except he can't write.
He's not a bad writer.
I'm being honest.
He's not passing.
I'm being honest. He can't, you know.
He did write in Denver. He was a writer
at one point. Not what you'd call a wordsmith. I mean, with all due respect.
I mean, it's functional. Functional?
Woj was a Travis McKenzie.
Woj was
a terrific columnist.
Yeah. He changed up to be a transaction.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
Yeah. It's more money in that, though. Yeah. Good for them.
Anyhow. Manny Osborne parody will join us. It's the 100th anniversary of Alpine Canada tomorrow. Manny's got a great story to tell, and he'll join us to tell it. It's Writer's Block with Blair and Deitch on 590 and 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, welcome back to Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Sportsnet 360. Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch, very pleased to be joined in studio by Manny Osborne parody. We mentioned it's tomorrow is the 100th anniversary of Alpine Canada, and there will be a gala in Toronto to celebrate that. You going to beat the gala?
Absolutely.
You're going to beat the gala? Good.
Any reason to put a suit on?
Yeah, well, why not? I mean, galas are not meant to be wasted. We talked a little bit off the air, and of course, you had that accident in Lake Louise, and your rehab is over from it, and you are now sort of in the process of building up towards, I think you said early May. Tell us a little bit about the rehab, and just what it's like to have an injury like that. It was, a broken tibial fracture that was this 5 of 6, as I said. I don't know what a Schatzker scale is, but when you're 5 of 6 in anything, it sounds pretty serious. Just tell us about the process of rehabbing, where you are now, and what your goals are as you look towards 2020.
Yeah, I don't think anybody should really need to know what a Schatzker 6 or 5 or 4 is.
You don't ever want to hear that again?
No,
I apologize for saying that.
Unless you're in med school, really.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I do know what it is, and pretty much it's a shattered leg. So they put an arthritic hip bone in my leg, and they replaced my bone. And then they built up my tibial plateau with bone cement and put a whole bunch of screws in there, and off we went. So... And off we went.
I went in a
wheelchair to the couch for 4 months.
But yeah.
Off I went. So that was kind of the first part of the rehab, was really just Netflix and chill.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I was able to start putting weight on it, we went 20 pounds every couple of days. And literally I had a scale and I would stand on it for a couple minutes. And that was my exercise. And through all of my surgeries, I lost quite a bit of blood. Mm-hmm. A normal hemoglobin count is around, I believe, 135, 140. And at one point, I was down to 40. And so for a large portion of the first part of the rehab, it was the big part was just sitting up,
mm-hmm.
and trying not to pass out, or, you know, maybe I'd only have an hour or two of energy during the day, and then the rest would be sleeping. So I feel really great now. The process has been long and tedious, but I feel really good, and it's been really nice since a couple weeks ago that I'm off just the straight rehab program, where it's really just going to physio, stretching, you know, a couple muscle activations here and there, but Now I'm back in the gym. I'm cleared to start training. You know, I'm doing some squats and I'm actually using the leg press. And you know, the goal now is to get fit and you know, my muscles have huge amounts of atrophy, and get those firing and building, and you know, the bone's good. So it's all the other part now.
I was going to say at some point you have to put a lot of pressure on that bone, and at some point you're going to be skiing again. That to me is I'm not a high performance athlete, obviously. That's where I'd be scared as hell, to be honest. Just that first time I had to push that leg, and then the first time I have to get in skis and go really fast down the hill. How do you overcome that type of reticence or reluctance? Or is it just a matter of you've got confidence in yourself and your team?
Well, all I have is a theory right now because
okay,
I haven't done it. So I, you know, I'm as oblivious as maybe you are to how this is going to be. But talking with other athletes that have gone through leg breaks, especially one of the big things is I've built an actual carbon fiber cast that goes into my ski boot and then wraps around my whole leg, so there won't be any weak links when I'm pushing on my boot.
Right,
and everything's a process, and I think it sounds like Didier Couche, who's one of the best downhillers ever, he did this when he broke his leg, and he said, as you become more confident and your leg feels better, just take your carbon fiber plate and or wrap mm-hmm. and cut an inch off.
Right,
and just keep doing that as it feels better, and we'll see how that goes. And having this whole winter, we're not rushing back to racing. Mm-hmm. My world rankings are frozen. I've got all the time in the world this winter to really ease into it and to do it properly because we only have one shot.
Right.
You know, it's a two years after this will be the Olympics. That's absolutely the last season that I'll ski. And, mm-hmm. You know, I'm old. I don't bounce back as quick. So we have one shot to do this well and right. And it's already, I mean, the odds are not in our favor, so we got to do it right.
Jeff hit on this a little bit, Manny, but I wonder how much a psychologist or a mental coach like is involved in this. In you've obviously skied your whole life, you've had immense success, but is part of the rehab to talk to someone about just even overcoming trepidation, fear of going back on a course, trepidation of competing against people who have not been hurt, trepidation of just can you be who you once were? A lot of the physical part I feel like can heal and you can do the training, but there's this whole other component, the mental part. How do you approach that?
Oh, it's absolutely the untalked about. It's the part that separates all the athletes that are racing World Cup to the athletes that aren't as well. I believe full-heartedly that's the only reason why we're there is your mental metal. Mm-hmm. And one thing to note is how well you can suppress fear or the unknowns or doubt.
Yeah.
Because you don't get rid of it. It's there, but you have to suppress it and it comes out at another point, but cameras are off and nobody mm-hmm. sees you, you know? But I it's going to be a huge journey. I think one thing that you touched on there was that the other athletes are not injured. Every athlete on the World Cup has been injured. We're definitely in a sport of if not when, right. Or sorry, when not if. So that's happened. So everybody's dealt with this. Right from the get-go, my sports psych was meeting with me in the hospital. Did that do any good? Probably not at the time. I was on hydromorphine. I really, unless my wife right. told me later that he had come, you know, I don't right. remember those times. But I do think that it's a process that has to be worked on continuously through what the healthy parts of my career, but even more so now. And it's something that we've put off because we know how much work we'll have to put in once I'm back on snow and how to figure out how to turn your brain off and on at the proper times. I'm not sure exactly what I would call this, but I was using this guy out of Portland, Oregon at one point, and we would call in and man, I'm not really sure what it was called, but we would do a meditative form of acknowledging the injury. And there's a lot of studies showing, especially in your legs and your lower limbs, when you injure a dominant leg. So I'm left-handed. So I broke my left foot, that there's a lot of mental bridges, a lot more, I don't want to say bridges, but like there's a lot of barriers to overcome when it's your dominant
the strongest part of your body, right? It's let you down essentially.
Yes. And because you couldn't walk or anything. So I was working with this guy, and it was amazing when you would go into a meditative state and you would acknowledge the pain and the fact that you couldn't stand on this. And at the time, you know, I couldn't do anything. Like, this was all I could do. This was just part of my rehab. And once you started acknowledging where the pain was and understanding and letting your brain not use a crutch to avoid it, but actually use it, it was amazing that the breakthroughs that we would have, as far as all of a sudden I would be able to sit up from a lying stance using my left leg, where my body wasn't worried about it. It knew that it was going to hurt, but we had kind of worked through the process in the brain that it wasn't fight or flight. So I think we haven't even scratched the surface of how much we can use our brains in sport. As much as the sports science side is surging in every sport, we could go so far beyond. And I think that it's definitely going to be the biggest battle once I push out of the start gate.
Tell us a little bit about Harvard as well. You are going to Harvard, taking a course during this time. Tell us about that course.
Yeah, I'm in a program crossing over from sport to business. Lots of other cool athletes in there. And I'm going to go down there next week. I'm going to stay with Mark Fain. He played for Edmonton. He's in the course. And Caroline Wozniacki is in my class. And there's a bunch of NBA guys. And it's been eye-opening. You know, it's been the perfect program for injury. And it's a bunch of work, but it's not overloaded.
So life is for essentially making smoother a transition into a life in business after you're done?
Absolutely. I without quoting the professor, I feel that it's as athletes are retiring at such a later age, there's not a, you need to transition into the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And you have so many talents that you've progressed through with either having an agent or working with agents and contract work, and then you know, the visions and you know, most people have run foundations or been part of foundations, and you have so many business qualities, but they're not structured business qualities,
right?
You know, it's all go and learn it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And having a program, and we're teamed up with two second year MBA students from Harvard, and they're in a class. It's called BEMs, and it's business and entertainment, music and sports, and you know, they may not have ever met any athletes, and so they get teamed up with an athlete, and all the case studies we do, we would just work together, and they do them in class, mm-hmm. and then we work via Skype on these cases, be it the financials or how we would progress that business plan or whatever. But it's very cool. I mean, they have said that a lot of the ideas that the athletes bring to the table were never brought up in class,
right?
Just because of maybe our age or experience or whatnot. And it's nice to add to the group and have thoughts that qualify as an additive, but also just the amount of knowledge that these students have to give to us, and for the most part, they're probably just learning that all these athletes they're learning about are just people, you know, and
right.
Yeah, it's an amazing program. I'm really honored to have been accepted into it.
How did you find out about it?
Lindsay Vaughn, she went last year. Her and PK went last year, and I followed the professor on Instagram, and if you go onto the website, Harvard website, there's an application process, and they do it every semester. And it started, Chris Bosch and a couple athletes started it, I think, 3 years ago, and then I believe this is its fifth or sixth semester that it's been running. And it's stemmed from the NBA to tennis, NBA, and now with this class, there was a one MLS or two MLS guys, some WNBA women, tennis stars, and yeah, a whole plethora of athletes.
What is an optimum timetable for you in terms of from today, when you don't ultimately want to get back to competitive skiing, to ultimately what your long-term goal would be, qualification for the Olympics?
Yeah, timeline. I mean, I've got this winter to get to 100% or as close as I can. Maybe it's my new normal, my new 100%, whatever that means. It's to be strong, be as pain-free as possible, and be able to make an educated decision if I can pursue an Olympic dream. Let's not call it a dream anymore. If I can pursue the Olympic team, or if that's just a pipe dream at this point. And this has happened over multiple injuries. Every injury, you come back, you persevere, you push hard, you see what your new norm is. And then if you can compete, you do it. And I mean, that happened when I blew my knee and all sorts of different injuries, back problems. And I don't think that this is any different. More severe, but again, the process is the same. May take longer, but again, the same. So May 1st, that's when the guys get off off the season. Our off season is generally March, April, mostly April, and then May 1st is when we bang it back off in the gym and try and build up our strength before we head on snow in July. So at May 1st, if I'm able to do it just like a normal program, April off, May 1st, make the decision. I will have it. It's not a one-day decision. Right. I will know, right? But and then push on, get back with the team and do preseason training. And every day counts on snow. I would say this is not any injury. For the most part, you need about 45 days on snow to of good quality training to be ready for the race season. And that wouldn't be any different. Maybe with the time off I've had, let's call it 55 days. But it's about that range.
Manny, listen, we really appreciate you joining us. We wish you all the best, both in your competitive career and post-career as well. Hopefully you can delay the post-competitive aspect of it by a couple of years. Manny Osborne-Parody joining us in Writer's Block. We'll be back with more on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Wamba qualifies as a guilty pleasure. They're a legit band. It's Travis McKenzie's guilty pleasure. Derek Brandeo wants me to name their second song. I don't know. Doesn't matter.
Maybe in the eye of the beholder, but I like that as a guilty pleasure selection. Could live with that. I like Manny. He's kind of an introspective, philosophical dude. You're looking at me like I'm crazy.
No, I'm not. I'm
mesmerized.
Take us through to 355.
Let's see if I can get us there.
Take us through to 355.
We were talking in the break, Jeff, about would you sort of take the challenge of going downhill on some mountain? I would not. No chance. Yeah, but you have snowboarded. I have not done that.
Yeah, snowboard was easy.
That sounds cool to me.
Only because I didn't downhill ski, so I didn't have to unlearn anything. Which is that's true. I've never downhill skied. My wife downhill skis. I never downhill skied. So when I took snowboarding lessons or snowboard lessons, the instructor was happy because he said I didn't have to unlearn anything.
I love that.
Snowboarding's fun.
It'd be super fun.
I don't
go sledding.
I don't do it four or five times a year. We should go sledding. Sledding's great.
Awesome.
crazy carpeting and all that.
And I've gone cross country skiing, but never snowboarding.
Yeah. Lots of cross country skiing
downhill
in Manitoba.
Seems insane to me. That
there are several things I would not do in sports, and I'm with you. One of them is
would you,
downhill
would you,
skiing.
I mean, again,
I would not downhill
at our
skiing.
Age, probably not doing this anyway. Would you, in your prime, in your youth, would you have jumped off?
I had no prime because in my youth I was.
Would you have jumped off a?
No,
like one of those cliffs in Mexico or something.
No, no,
like
no. Same no, here. The word you used immediately turned me off. There will be no jumping.
Yeah,
on this part.
That's just the.
There was.
Have you ever bungee jumped?
I have never bungee jumped.
Have you ever gotten a helicopter?
I have. Yes, when I was really, really young, I went in a rickety old Army helicopter.
Which I'd like to do that once.
But that was I haven't. Yeah, bungee jumping just not happening. Zip lining, I got no interest in that.
Would you? I'm sure the answer would be no. Mm-hmm. But would you ever parachute out of a plane?
Not a chance in hell would I parachute out of a plane.
People who died, that is. I mean, I admire them greatly. It just seems like I just don't think I could do it.
I don't have enough. I don't have enough trust in humanity to jump out with a pack that someone else has.
Travis
packed.
Playing around with your parachute.
What?
Travis playing around with your parachute before the show.
I just don't have any. I'm not going to trust somebody.
Yeah, I mean that's
to do that, and I'm sure as hell not going to.
It's amazing.
I'm not going to take the time to. Well, they don't do it every day.
I'm people in certain industries.
Yeah, like paratroopers.
Yeah, paratroopers or
accountants don't do it every.
No, accountants don't do it every day, but first responder types. Yeah. Anyway, I don't know how we got on this topic.
Yeah, I don't either. Because first responders.
I like the in studio guest. I think it's cool. I actually like our show when it's three people. I actually think the dynamic is interesting. You agree? I'll take that as a yes. I'll take your no response as a yes. Who's coming up in a 4 o'clock hour? Anybody good?
Fun. It was fun. Freege is coming on.
Love Freege.
Freege is coming on.
I actually don't know who our second guest is. Do you?
Does this throw Travis under the bus?
No,
it's Gord Stellick.
Gord Stellick. I had a TBA in my head. All right. Gord Stellick
is coming.
Hockey hour.
It'll be a full hour of hockey leading up to tonight's big game between the Kings and
bosses will be very happy.
Between the Kings and the Leafs. It'll be a fabulous game tonight. John Tavares back in the lineup for the Leafs. Nick Batan. Looking forward to it. No Jason Spezza. I'm going to go to the game tonight. See what happens.
But you're not writing off. You're going to write a couple days from now.
It depends if anything exciting happens.
I was just going to ask you. I know we're going quick. But if something – you have essentially the – maybe carte blanche is too blasé word, but if something like monumental happens tonight, you can write though, right?
No, they got other people there who can do it.
Seriously, you can't just call some Sportsnet digital editor and be like, "I really got something to say on this one."
No,
really?
No,
Blair, you have more juice than I think you think.
No, 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 you got too many people.
It's the first of all, it's the web. You can never have enough content.
Yeah, I'll take it under advisement.
All right.
Elliot Friedman has his 31 thoughts up on the website. I'm going to give Elliot a lot of credit for this. He has managed to sort of almost make sense of the whole Dustin Byfuglien thing for me.
Yes, he has.
Which is really hard because I still don't necessarily know what the hell's happening with Dustin Byfuglien. But as I said, Elliot's come close as anybody to explaining it. And he's got some thoughts as well on Travis Dermott, Zach Hyman's returned. And what that may mean for the Toronto Maple Leafs. They do have some interesting decisions to make. And, Elliot Friedman will join us next. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Unconfirmed sources say this is the best show in the history of sports radio. You simply the best. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch. Better than all the rest. On Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, welcome to Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360. It is Jeff Blair, Richard Deitch. Elliot Friedman. How you doing, man?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, because I've got in my hot little hands your hot little story, 31 Thoughts, what's next in complicated Byfuglien situation.
I would call it not hot. I would call it lukewarm.
Almost understand it now.
What could I do to push you over the cliff so you fully understand it?
why? That's, you know, honestly, like, you know, it's interesting because we had Timmy Campbell on. And he was talking about he's the exact same thing you said about Dustin Byfuglien. I mean, you put it differently, but you said Dustin Byfuglien's one of those guys that, you know what, you expect people to do this, he's going to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the way he is. But I just, between team, agent, and player.
Yep.
If it was just team and player, but between team, agent, and player, how does this happen?
In terms of what? Like, because I think since I wrote this today,
yeah,
somebody said to me that the biggest thing that's changed is the involvement of the NHL.
Okay.
Like, the Jets are out of this.
Okay, so this is now, okay.
They are now basically, so you've got, it's almost like Byfuglien and the Jets and the agent were the initial players.
And now everybody.
And now it's the NHL and the Players Association head-to-head. Like, the Jets have been told, you can't say anything, and we're handling this for now.
Right.
And realizing that, I think the Players Association is becoming more involved in Byfuglien's side of it.
Okay, because, you know, I exchanged texts with a baseball trainer. And I just asked him kind of about exit medicals and all that.
Yeah.
And those are sacrosanct. Like, that's professional.
That's what the NHL's fighting.
That's what, and this guy said, look, he said, frankly, if that's me, and I'm the trainer of that team, or I'm the person who performed the medical procedure, because he said there can be three or four people in there, can be a specialist, there can be the team doctor, but he said, that's my credibility on the line.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, by extension, you could argue that the credibility of the system is on the line here as well, which would explain why the NHL is so, you know, focused on this.
Well, that's where Brian Burke really helped me out, because Burke is a former general manager. He understands how this process works. When I talked to him on Saturday about what I'd heard about the physical,
right?
You know, he was really interested in that. He did some more research. He helped me out with understanding the process about how the physical is signed by the player, the team, and the doctor. And there's another form that's just solely signed by the doctor. And why that form is, it's called the 25A. There is a right in the CBA that the players are allowed to seek second opinions. Mm-hmm. And if the player disagrees with what's on that form, which says fit to play, they can go get a secondary opinion. And that's basically what we're fighting over here is Byfuglien saying, yeah, okay, maybe you said I was fit to play at the end of the year, but when I got back skating in September, I guess it was, or late August, I didn't feel good. And we'll see. Yeah.
I just, that seems like a pretty significant injury to miss.
Well, I think, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the reason is, like,
I understand that
the one thing guys always want, first of all, I don't know everything. I can only tell you what I've heard. So there's probably some gray area there I don't know. So I hesitate to come out and say one side's wrong over the other. So this is everything. I laid out everything I knew. The other thing, too, is you can never guess what an arbitrator is going to do. Like, I've had the NHL walk into situations before and the Players Association walk into situations before saying, we're going to win this one.
Mm-hmm.
And only to walk out and say, holy smokes, we lost. Or holy smokes, like, we're not happy. So I think if it even gets close to that, Richard and Jeff, we'll get a settlement done. But I think the Jets want this guy to play for them at the end of the day.
Ellie, what's interesting, and, you know, I realize there's sort of the contractual end of this, and then there's the player part of this. And, you know, it's a situation, and I imagine this happens a lot in the league, but this is very public, where – you know, a guy doesn't know if he wants to play at a certain point in his career. And, you know, this is not going to happen, obviously, but, you know, you wonder if there should be a place like that exists for, I don't even know what you'd phrase it as, like a reserve list, where a player would have the right, if they decided a couple of months into a season, health-wise or mental-wise, that they wanted to come back. But the most interesting thing about Byfuglien to me, and I, the contract part is really interesting, is that he really does strike me as a guy who doesn't know. Or maybe there's a part of him that believes he should play, and yet the body is telling him something else. You know, it's just, it's it's an interesting situation to me because there are players who seem to know when they want to leave the game, and then there are others who they're told to leave the game. In his case, it feels like it's in the middle.
Well, somewhere. I think the one thing I absolutely 100% believe in all this is that he went away in the summer thinking, yeah, I'm going to just relax and do nothing and I'm going to heal up. And when he started skating and it hurt him, that he was like, forget this. I mean, I got to play 100 games this year the way I like to play.
Exactly.
He plays 25 minutes a night. 100%, I could see him saying, you know what, screw this. I want no part of this. It's no fun. And, you know, as I wrote, there's a few people who said to me, right when this first got reported, they said to me, why didn't he just show up and go on injured reserve? Say, I'm getting a rehab schedule and I'm going on injured reserve. And the reason was he probably just didn't want to go in every day, be forced to skate at 8 a.m. or do his work at 8 a.m. Like, he's just not wired that way.
Yeah.
And that's added another layer to this. I think that what it comes down to is it's Dustin. As guys told me, they kind of laugh. It's like Dustin Byfuglien, he's a simple guy who likes to go out on his off days and fish on the and do ice fishing. And, you know, things that are important to other people, they're not important to him. And you can't judge what he does based on what you do because he's not like the rest of us. He thinks differently. He acts differently. And what matters to us probably doesn't matter to him.
You know, Jeff, I just want to just add really quick. The one thing that'll be interesting for me with this guy is you have seen instances in sports where there's a lot of physicality, particularly in football, where if a guy walks away from for a year, his body does feel different that following year and they can't come back. The most recent example of this, and again, I realize it's different sports, is Jason Witten, who went to Monday Night Football, didn't play for a year, and said his body really feels refreshed this year. So I will be curious. If he doesn't end up playing this year, I'll be very curious to see how and what he is saying next August if his body feels different.
That's a good question. You know, that's because nothing would surprise me. Like if he came back, if he took this whole year off and then came back in the summer and says, I want to play again.
Yeah.
I mean, the other factor with that too, and I better check this, you've just put it in my head, Richard, is does it reach a point where the league can, or the Jets, league and the Jets can say we're tolling the contract? Like you still owe him 2 years.
Yeah.
You can't just walk away without one. That's come up before. It came up in the whole Yashin thing in Ottawa. Now that I've given it away on the air, I better check it.
We'll expect to see an update as soon as possible.
32 thoughts, Matt.
32 thoughts, exactly. Thought number 32. The Leafs take on the Kings tonight.
Yep.
What are the Kings?
The Kings are a team that is still rebuilding. Like, they're starting. Like, you know, it's funny, you know, it's not fun for them. Like, there are guys like Kopitar and Doughty, like, you can see how much they hate to lose. Justin Brown, how much they hate to lose. But I've got to tell you, and I was talking about this with one of them yesterday, as much as this sucks, you take it to win 2 Stanley Cups.
Right. Yeah.
Like, if I'm a fan of the LA Kings or I play for the LA Kings or run the team, I'm like, if this is the price I have to pay for winning 2 Stanley Cups, I take it.
But how far away are they from being?
A long way.
They are a long way. You know, they have not even finished the teardown.
No, and they're still in the middle of it. Like, they've got, you know, Doughty is an all-world player still. Kopitar is an all-world player still. They have, there's a guy named Corey Priman who writes for The Athletic, who I think is very insightful in his prospect rankings. And he's got them, I think, 4th overall.
Okay.
And they do believe that some of their kids who are years away still are talented. They have to figure it out. But there's a bunch of guys in the middle. It's, you know, it's Jeff Carter. It's Alec Martinez. It's Tyler Toffoli. It's Trevor Lewis. Like, those guys, if other teams are interested, they're all available. Their middle class is definitely available.
Elliot, I wanted to ask you what you thought of the Lucic suspension in terms of the amount of days that he got.
I wasn't surprised. You know, there was, you know, it was interesting. You know, did you read his comments today? Did you see?
No.
So he basically said he was upset about it. And, you know, he said that, look, the guy hacked at our goalie. Riddick actually, I think, came out and thanked Lucic for what he did, standing up for him. And Lucic made a comment like, you know, when I started, when a scrum like that happened, everybody protected themselves. And, you know, it was funny. You know, I worked, obviously, I worked with PJ, mm-hmm. worked with Nick, and that was the way they talked. Like, if you did that to a goalie, you know, you had to be ready for that.
You had to be aware that
you
there
knew
was going to be.
Now, the game has changed so much, and our priorities as a society in terms of protecting the head have changed so much, and fighting has gone down so much that, you know, Cole Sherwood obviously comes from a generation where you don't think like that. And I think the way the NHL looks at it is, if you are a willing participant, you know, Richard, if we both go into a corner, we battle for the puck, we look at each other, and the gloves go down, hey, we're both willing participants.
Right.
But if there's an unwilling participant, which Sherwood was, they look at it a lot differently now.
I just, my own editorializing of it is, I don't know how the NHL could not have suspended him for 2 years. Like, the everything you said is dead on, and it's really interesting culturally about the game, but the video evidence is what it is, and by the letter of the law, how could he not get a couple games?
You know, I have to tell you something. I saw that on Saturday night because we're watching all the games. Maybe it's just the generation I grew up in. I didn't even think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was, you know, the one I thought was suspendable was the one in San Jose, Vancouver, when Brendan Dillon hit Sautner.
Right.
And Sautner was injured. He missed the game. He left the game. Like, I thought that was late. And I was actually thinking, okay, are they going to review that one? Could Dillon be in trouble? And then someone said, well, the NHL Player Safety Department just tweeted out that there's a hearing. And I go, oh, for Dillon. I go, no, for Lucic. And I was like, what? Really? Like, of the – and maybe that's just where the age I grew up in. But once I really thought about it, hey, if you're a willing participant, that's one thing. But if you're not, I think the league looks very harshly on
them. But it's interesting you made that point, because it shows, doesn't it, just how – younger players now, I mean, they literally came up in a different time.
100%.
Learned their hockey or played their hockey in a different time. Like, I'm sure he probably never occurred to Cole Sherwood that he was going to, just didn't occur to him.
Where did you start your career?
When?
Yeah.
79.
And were you first in Winnipeg or were you in Montreal? So the Jets are in there, right?
Yeah. Jimmy Mann.
So like, who was the goalie of the Jets at the time when you first started covering?
As a Jets fan, it was Joe Daly and Ernie Wakely, but Doug Sotard and Ed Stanowski were the pairing.
Actually, it's funny. I saw Ed Stanowski on a plane going out.
Did he really?
He looks great. Like, he looks better than I do.
We used to call him Saturday Night Eddie because it was the only time he'd win a game was. Was well, when he
it's like Cameron Carter, right? Like, you knew you're on TV.
That's right.
But like, so imagine, take you back to 1979. You're starting your career. Ed Stanowski's in goal.
Yeah.
And you're playing whoever, and they run and they do that to Stanowski.
Yeah. That's
like, there's a brawl.
Yeah.
And whoever does that to Stanowski, he knows there's a brawl.
And you would probably assume in some instances you may be doing that to incite some sort of brawl.
And nobody's getting suspended.
No.
That everybody's getting 2 minutes for roughing.
Right.
And now, you know, Sherwood does that. And even though, and I thought it was interesting how Riddick and the GM rallied around Lucic because they're trying to build up his confidence, right? So, but, you know, it just shows you how much the thinking has evolved and the game has evolved.
Yeah.
Elliot, Jeff and I were talking about this earlier. The John Tavares coming back.
Yep.
Dermott's back. Zach Hyman coming back
soon.
It strikes me, or maybe it struck us, that over the next whatever you want to do, 30 days, 40 days, we're really going to get a sense of what
this is.
Kyle,
it.
Yeah, this Kyle Dubas envisioned team is.
This is it.
Yeah. One, do you agree with that? And two, and this is sort of an additional thought on that, will Cody Ceci be part of, at this point, what that possibility is, where he is?
Well, I think that's all going to be determined over the next 20 to 30 games. I know that as they got closer to being healthy and Dermott came back and Tavares came back, is coming back, and Hyman could be back as soon as next week. There were teams calling them. Who are you going to move? What are you going to do? And locally, that we've kind of always been under the belief that they would clear out some of the bottom of their lineup. But I think teams check to make sure. What are you thinking with this guy or that guy? And they've told everybody, we're going with this. We're going to ride this group now. Like, as long as nobody gets hurt, we're going to ride this group once Hyman gets back. We've got to really find out what we've got. So, yes, I do think that this is the next – this is the group. And right now I think CC is part of that. Could it change? Sure, it could change. But right now I think he's part of that. I think they want to see – this on paper was the full-strength team.
Right.
And they want to see it for a while, barring injury.
Sort of playing off Cody Ceci. Do you think there's a chance at some point that we will see Tyson Berry and Morgan Riley on the same pairing for a consistent period of time? Because it does seem as if Morgan Riley's game isn't what it was last year. Admittedly, there may be a
he's battling issue. Something.
There's, yes, he... I
only recently, like, he's starting to practice again, which
is because he missed four practices,
and
at
he
one
was
point.
Skating on the optionals, right?
Okay,
like he would skate the morning skates, but right where it was optional.
I'm wondering if maybe the idea of trying to get Tyson Berry going and putting him with
well, the one thing I wondered is if they would put Berry on the first power play.
Yeah,
okay,
that was the one thing, especially if Riley's not.
They tried against Washington,
100% healthy.
Yeah.
Well, there was one on Philly where I thought they did it, and Chris Johnston pointed out to me that it was actually a line change. I didn't see it all evolve. And thank you, Chris, for catching that before I said anything. That's what I would have thought was put Berry on the first power play to get him going. You know, the one thing, you know, I wonder about all this with Berry is, you know, he's in a contract year.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, you know, you're sitting here, he's probably wondering, you know, how is this whole thing going to affect his next contract, which is never an easy frame of mind to be in. But, again, I think all of these answers are going, we're going to have a better idea of the answers to these questions as long as everybody stays healthy over the next 2 months. I think we really do.
Yeah, I mean, Ali, my guess is you're about to repeat yourself with the same answer. One of the things that has not been discussed over the last couple of days, because there have been other topics in Leafland, has been the backup goaltender.
Yes.
Do you get a sense that you think Hutchinson is on more than a one, at this point, a one-game trial? Or, like, will he, you think, legit get over the next 30 to 45 days a couple starts, and then they're going to decide – like, is this the guy or not?
I think they've been looking for help.
Okay. It would strike me that they would not be doing due diligence unless they did.
I think they're looking for help. I think they've been looking for help for some time.
Is help out there?
It's just that, you know, they're really tight, right? You know, the help has to come in at a certain dollar figure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're in long-term injury. They're going to be in long-term injury all year. I think, honestly, Richard, I think help is out there. But it has to be out there at a certain price.
Right.
Like, I'm 100% convinced that when Louis Domingue was put on waivers by Tampa Bay at the beginning of the year, they looked at it. But Louis Domingue's making over $1 million, and, you know, they couldn't make it work. Like, this is a guy who just got traded for a conditional seventh-round draft pick.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
The Leafs could – a guy won 21 games last year. Now, a lot of that was the machine of Tampa, but there's a goalie there. And I'm sure they looked at it, but they can't – that I don't think it was just it was not financially feasible.
Friedge, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
31 Thoughts by Elliot Friedman up on the website. Leafs and Kings tonight. We'll take a break. Be back with more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
As we continue with Travis McKenzie's Guilty Pleasures playlist.
This feels like too... This is not Guilty Pleasure. I feel like this is a hit.
No, this ought to be... This isn't a Guilty Pleasure. This is Guilty as charged. Radio listeners, it is Coldplay. What is the name of this?
How can any Coldplay song be a Guilty Pleasure?
What is the name of this song?
This is Fix You by Coldplay, which Fix is roundly you, yeah. ridiculed on the internet.
Come yeah. on, Travis. That's way too popular to be Guilty Pleasure.
You've clearly never watched HBO's The Newsroom.
What's your next choice? Sympathy for the Devil?
It could be. We still have time.
So people in TV don't get to hear this, do they? They get to hear the music? We've been doing Guilty Pleasures all week. We'll continue to do Guilty Pleasures all
Who's
week.
Who's tomorrow, Brandeo or Jen?
Jen Rolnick is tomorrow.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah. Brandeo's going to be the closer on Friday.
Brandeo's going to have some like, very obscure like stuff, I know. Like,
yeah.
Some
maybe a little Afro Man. Maybe a little Afro Man.
Bournemouth band from like 1966 or something like that.
Anyhow. We have Gord Stellick.
Speaking of.
Which? No, Travis is. Travis is going to. Guess what Travis is doing?
We don't have Gord yet?
Travis is getting Gord Stellick. He was busy enjoying the music.
You know, Gord Stellick is a devout tennis player, loves the sport, loves to play it. Found that out the last time I talked to Gord.
A devout tennis player?
Plays, I think he has like a standing doubles match like every, he could tell, it's like every Tuesday or Thursday. But he's really into it. He's a big tennis guy, which I like hearing. Carolyn Cameron, big tennis person at the station, Gord Stellick. I like to collect all the tennis people because I know there's not many of them here. And I consider myself a tennis person, so that's why.
You're really reaching, aren't you?
I'm trying to fill before Gord comes on. You should thank me.
I love Travis's voice.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Hell is this? What's the name of that guilty pleasure? That's like almost life in prison guilty.
This is Bring It All Back by S Club 7.
Bring It All Back by S Club 7. All right, well, that would fall under guilty pleasure. Or someone's guilty pleasure. Travis's guilty pleasure.
Travis, young Travis, tell me what Drew Doughty said today that got everybody's knickers in a knot. Because I thought yesterday he handled the whole question about the Leafs and the question that got Alex Ovechkin in trouble. Well, it got him in trouble. Didn't get him in trouble, but...
Got him attention.
Got him attention. Jim Ralph, I thought, said it best about that comment. He said it seemed less a criticism than a confession on the part of Alex Ovechkin.
Good line.
Which I think is exactly what it was. It was, hey... Based on my recollection of what it was like to choke all the time in the playoffs, this is what it felt like. Now, Drew Doughty is a different character, though, in that Drew Doughty has been linked to the Leafs in the past as a free agent. And he's kind of toyed around a little bit with the Toronto media when it's come to that. But essentially, you know... Drew said something in Vancouver that was taken out of context. And, you know, it's strange because we want our athletes to be in engaging interviews. And, you know, the flip side of that is when they do say something, it gets spun and spun and spun and analyzed and talked about. And it's, I see why guys get to a point where they're almost reluctant to even address anything that is a remotely, not even controversial, but something that requires a little bit of nuance. We don't do nuance as well as we used to in this industry.
Well, I think, first of all, I agree with you on that. But I think a big product of that, Jeff, is social media, in that people, including media, by the way, fans as well, are so quick to comment on what constitutes a headline or what constitutes a partial clip on something. And in order to get nuance, you have to invest in the reading of something. You have to invest in the larger story. So I am with you in that. I really appreciate the athletes and the coaches who are still transparent and honest with the media, because the reality is, and again, I don't want to be out of business, of course, but the reality is, Jeff, the less you say, the better position you are, is generally speaking, as an athlete. It's like the Derek Jeterization of being a star, is that the more boring you are, the better position you're going to be in because you don't have to deal with anything external. It's just internal.
A couple of things have happened. First of all, the notion that the media is the conduit through which the fans interact with players and vice versa is wrong. It's not the conduit anymore. That would be social media. The idea that players are obliged to answer questions, contractually, they're sort of, kind of obliged to make themselves available at certain times.
It's a key point. They're contracted to make themselves available, not necessarily to answer. You agree? Yeah,
there's a difference between making yourself available and saying that I am going to answer your question.
Right.
And, I mean, I've always said if I was a professional athlete, I would do exactly what Derek Jeter did. I'd make eye contact. I'd be polite. I wouldn't roll my eyes and say that's a dumbass question, but I wouldn't give you anything. And there's just no – athletes make so much money now. The – endorsements, people used to always talk about, well, you've got to be open with the media because that way you'll, maybe you'll get endorsements. No, it's got nothing to do with endorsements anymore. How you are with the media has nothing to do with endorsements.
Agreed, 1,000%.
I mean, it just doesn't. It's just got nothing to do with it. It's how successful you are, how presentable you are, how open you are to the public. So I think part of the issue is that I think the media, and I use that as a group, fighting a losing battle.
Two quick things I just want to add on top of what you're saying.
Let's play the Drew Doughty clip right away.
I mean, the guy's an idiot that
And this was him talking about a comment he made in Vancouver.
What I was trying to say there is they're a young team, we're an old team, we lost the game like 8-1 or something, and that's just ridiculous for a veteran team to lose that bad to any team in the league, not only a young team, but that was what I meant by those comments, so... The standard people making it run.
Is that why it's trouble for guys to have a personality?
Exactly. Like, if you guys want us to, like, be able to say things and be honest with you, and then you're going to go run with it and, just get attacked by it, we're just going to stop talking. So, that's
listen,
it.
I know where he's coming from, and I sense his frustration in his voice, and there's a lot of truth to that. The one thing I just want to say, Jeff, quickly, I really appreciate in 2019, with all the potential damage that can come, someone like Draymond Green or any athlete who's really honest and transparent in their sport, who answers questions knowing sometimes that it's going to get them in the soup, but they're being honest. That's point one. Point two, Jeff, to get to your point in terms of you would be Derek Jeter and you would approach it that way, here's a perfect example, no matter what you think of the situation. LeBron James being asked about democracy in Hong Kong is an impossible situation. He cannot please everybody, and the likelihood is he will end up displeasing more people than not. Obviously, I didn't love his answer, but that's the kind of thing, Jeff. Like, the best procedural thing for LeBron to do there would have been to say, I'm not taking any questions on this. Yeah. But then he would have been killed for not taking questions on it. So I totally empathize that there are certain situations where if you are a professional athlete at that level of stardom, you have no options.
I wonder if they had a redo, if the NBA wouldn't get the coaches, the general managers of the teams that were over there together and say, look, this is the message. This is what we're trying to do here. This is what we're going to say. We're going to say nothing else about it. Then what has to happen, the very first day, Adam Silver's got to get up there and deliver that message. Say, we're not here. Of course, it's BS, but we're not here to make a political statement. We're here to play basketball, grow the game, blah, 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 all the stuff that we're going to roll our eyes at. But it was a rare misstep by the NBA because generally the NBA gets its messaging really, really, really down. And they're pretty airtight a lot of the times.
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, you're right. It was an impossible situation for LeBron. You know what? You as a business, you should never put your employees in a situation where they can't win.
Great
they
point.
They can only lose.
What it did is it exposed the NBA being like every other organization in the world. Commerce first, principle second. And which is what the world is, but if you're a smart ownership or a smart commissioner, don't put your people in that position.
Exactly. And if it if you understand that that's the reality, it's up to you to handle it. It's up to you to address it. It's not up to LeBron. It's not up to anybody else. That's it for Writer's Block. We'll be back tomorrow. Have a great day, everybody.